more. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We're going back live on this network here on 90.1 FM in Austin. You can pick us up on our website, thesecrettruth.com. And we're back on the air again live. We've been doing encore presentations, and we want to thank our listening audience for supporting us in that endeavor. And I believe what we're going to start doing is we'll have encore presentations on the website, and then you can also listen to us here live on 90.1 FM in Austin, Texas. And then you can also in the future, we'll be picked up on shoutcast.com. We're not quite there yet. But anyway, we're going to talk about the Egyptian plantation tonight. There's a lot going on in Egypt. My gosh, they just changed out a president. President Morsi was replaced by this military junta. And that's a very interesting situation over there. It's amazing what's really going on, and that's what we're going to get down to tonight. I wrote a piece, and you can find it on thesecrettruth.com. So come into our website, thesecrettruth.com, and it's right at the top. Now, to get to the actual program part of it, you're going to have to scroll way down to get back to where it says program in there. And then you can pick up, and we're going to go ahead and put up another encore in there, but we'll also have this as our live program for tonight also. We'll have information about our live program. We'll also have information about the encores. That way you can go back and listen to an encore that we feel is one of our better programs at the time, or you can go into the web and pick us up there and listen to us live. Not right now, but in the future we'll be on Shoutcast and we'll make that available to you. In Egypt today, the turmoil is very great. The crowds you see on television, now Al Jazeera has been covering that. Their offices were closed by this military group there, the military armed forces. The armed forces of Egypt just recently closed down their channel there in Cairo. Qatar, they're connected back to Qatar, and Qatar has been supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's probably one of the reasons why they did that. What you're seeing here on the streets being played out before your eyes are the military. Morsi was elected about a year ago, almost to the day. And it was a legitimate election. He had about 51-52% of the vote. He had the Muslim Brotherhood backing him up 100%. So that's why he was able to come in as president. He did well for a while until about November of last year, around November 22nd. He started issuing decrees and shutting down certain judiciary parts of the judiciary. And this is where people got out on the streets and started protesting vehemently against these actions. They describe this as taking power and unconstitutionally. So I began to think about what was going on there, and I could not get from our mainline media a legitimate explanation of what was actually going on. So I went in and I did some study and research and so forth, and I found out a lot of very interesting things that are going on. And you have to go back in history a little bit to see what is actually going on. You know, about 2011, Hosni Mubarak was moved against and changed out. And then it took about a year for things to settle down until they could get an election. About a year ago, they had an election. And President Morsi, who was supported by the Muslim Brotherhood, went in. And he served about 1 year. And like I said, in November he made these decrees, and the military didn't like it, and the public in general didn't like it either. So they shut him down here just on the 3rd of July. July 3rd, 2013 is when they closed him down. If you go back to the period before Nasser was a strong man that took over in 1952 with a free officers movement. And this was a movement within the armed forces, within the army. And Nasser became the leader of that. And they threw out King Farouk the First of Egypt. He had lived a very sorry life. And so he was not well liked. And he was very wealthy. He threw his money around a lot. And a very obsessive spender and so forth. So the public didn't like him at all, and they resented his. He led a life of excess and opulence, and many of the citizens of Egypt resented him. So when they saw Nasser come in, a very forthright, and one thing about Nasser, President Nasser, who became president later, he had very little scandal, if any at all, in his administration as far as his personal life. He led a very upright life. But when he came in and ushered in some reforms. These reforms that he ushered in were very good reforms. One was land reform. Up until before Nasser took over, and there was a president there that he was the deputy to the president, Naguib, and he was in office for about a year, but Nasser was always behind the scenes and in controlling the government, and he really had the people behind him, the officers behind him. In fact, Anwar Sadat was one of those officers behind him during this period of time. But under King Farouk the First of Egypt, the farmers led a very, very poor existence, a very desolate existence. They were living on average wages of 8 to 15 piastres a day, which was nothing back then. They were also having to give to the landowner 75% of their income off of their crop income. And that's really flipped around in most cases here, even in the United States today. Someone that's renting property will usually pay 20-25% of the crop to their landowner. So that was totally unfair. One historian, Robert Stevens, had compared that state of the Egyptian peasants during the period under King Farouk to that of the French peasants before the French Revolution. So there were many historians and people looking at the time that had actual real-time experience that saw Egypt, and especially the farmer, being used, and it was like peasants and so forth that they were treated, and they were given nothing. And thus that's where I got my title, the Egyptian plantation. And what I'm maintaining later on in the piece here, my paper, is that early on it was an agricultural plantation, and then after the army took over, and Nasser actually made these reforms, not only land reforms, he did do that. He gave the farmers some land, which they had never been given before, and they were denied by these rich landowners. He broke up the big farms and into smaller pieces, and the small man, the small farmer, eventually ended up with at least a minimum 5 acres or more. up to 200 acres in some cases. So in doing that, he did get the productivity of the agricultural production up by doing that. The law number that the reform of that was law number 178. And if you go into thesecrettruth.com, you'll be able to read exactly the white paper that I put together, and you'll be able to see exactly what this reform was all about. And here's, I'll tick off some of the things. The landowners were prohibited to possess more than 200 fathoms of land. That's approximately a little over 200 acres. However, fathers with more than two children were allowed to own 300. So what he got it down to was that nobody could own over 300 acres with a family. And a limit on the rental rate for land was set at 7 times the land tax value of the plot of land, which would be about 14% versus 75%, okay? All land leases were given a minimum duration of 3 years, so you just couldn't lease it to someone and take it away from year to year. They wanted to be able to let farmers at least, on leases, be there for at least 2 or 3 years. They also established cooperatives for some of the farmers that were holding less than 5 acres approximately. And the members of these cooperatives worked together to obtain supplies such as fertilizer, pesticides, and seeds, as well as cooperating to transport their products to market. And then a minimum wage for agricultural workers was set at 18 piastres per day. And it went on like that. So the land reform that Nasser ushered in after the 1952 revolution, and that's when they threw out King Farouk, was good for the farmer in Egypt. Later on, that land reform would slowly be eroded by different administrations until during Anwar Sadat's administration, it finally vanished after his administration, and eventually most of that land reforms, those land reforms were eventually abolished. Today, if you look at the status there of Egypt and the agricultural, especially if you look at wheat, and if you look at just wheat itself, and that's a good barometer of the whole farming sector. Right now, Egypt only produces 50% of the wheat that they need for bread to feed the country. They have to rely on imports, and that's where they need foreign reserves, foreign dollar reserves, in fact, the international dollar, to buy this foreign wheat. The gluten level of their existing wheat in their country is not at a high enough level to keep that bread together, so they mix it in with this foreign bread to get a good mixture to produce a good loaf of bread. Now, they have some flat bread that is subsidized by the government. This goes way back to Nasser's, someone of his reforms, and you can buy a piece of flat bread for less than a cent a piece. And but I'm told that during these demonstrations and protests over there, there were reports that you could find pieces of this flatbread littering in some cases the streets, meaning that it would indicate that the subsidy was too great and the price was too low. Otherwise, they wouldn't have thrown it away like they did. So there is probably some need there to adjust the subsidy on bread in Egypt. I make about 7 different recommendations at the end of this paper, and one of those recommendations is to look at the subsidies and see what can be done to work with those. They do have gasoline down to about $1.75 a gallon, and so that's a pretty big subsidy there versus what we're paying, $3.50 to $4 a gallon here. Right now, their foreign reserves are down at their central bank, and they only have maybe 2 or 3 months of reserves or more to go. What we also discovered, Charlotte Littlefield helped me a great deal on this and some of the research, too. So I want to thank you, Charlotte, out there in the listening audience, and for helping do the research on this paper. The armed forces virtually, I have one section of this paper, I says, owns the economy. It's hard to get an exact handle on how much they actually own of the economy. It's somewhere between 20% on the low end to 40% on the high end. Most scholars and economists that write on this subject that have some knowledge of the ownership of the economy by the armed forces of Egypt say 35 to 40%. In one section of my paper there's an organization, an industrial organization called the Arab Organization for Industrialization. If you scroll down there and look at that and then click off on the products produced by the military, it will take you to a list of products that was in their site map. So I took their site map and actually I'm hypertext linking you into their site map. When Nasser took over in 1952, he not only did the land reforms and did the fuel and gasoline and stuff, but he also started nationalizing some industry. This meant that the government would immediately come into ownership of some industries that were privately owned before. So what this set up, though, was it started a foundation from which over successive decades, the armed forces of Egypt could gradually nationalize through nationalization and ownership from the state or purchase from the state, a private, public-private partnership, public-private partnership type of angle. They could have started acquiring an interest in industry and businesses, and that's exactly what they've done. The peace treaty that was struck between Egypt and Israel in 1979, what happened was after they established peace with Israel, they immediately began to understand that they didn't need this large army that they needed to have when they were still at war or in conflict with Israel. So they started directing many of their armed forces personnel into industrial and business types of endeavors. And what this did basically was take an armed forces, and many of the army people were led the way on this, started putting them to work in industry and started to develop industries and started building industries and acquiring businesses. And there's resort areas, there's land, there's a number of differing kinds of industry and businesses that they have set up. Nasser City, they developed that with condos and things like this. But what they basically established was a cash flow that would set the military up for future retirement and income benefits. And they had associates and friends that benefited along with this military through the development and the ownership of these businesses. So this was very, very key in the expansion of the military and in acquiring a greater ownership of business, of the economy. And that's why some scholars are saying 35 to 40% was the percentage that they believe the armed forces owns at this time. Morsi had a little over a year in office, if that. I think he was elected on the 30th. He assumed office on June 30th, 2012. And his term lasted until July the 3rd, 2013. Egypt's defense minister, General Sisi, dismissed President Morsi on that date, on July 3rd, just a few days ago, 3 days ago now. And we have a speech that I pulled up. Al Jazeera has a translation into English, and I was following very closely during this disorder and this chaos over there and this protest movement, the Al Jazeera channel. And if there's anything in the Middle East and you know Al Jazeera is on the ground, go in there. They'll have live shots and live reporting from the scene. They had camera shots from up above Tahrir Square, and they were explaining it and talking to some local scholars and things like this about what was actually going on the ground below. But what actually happened is that Marcy, to many in the military and the public in general, felt threatened by these decrees. So they decided to protest. There was an economic downturn, too, that occurred over this last year. And during this economic downturn, then you had people that were having a harder time of eating and so forth. And this was a period of time where the economics went against his administration. Some economists are saying that what Marcy should have done was tend to the economy first and then get back to his own goals that actually centered around making the government more Islamic in character. He wanted to change the judiciary into much more of a Sharia law courts and so forth. And Egypt being secular in many of the segments of the government for decades were not going to be receptive to those kinds of overtures and goals that Marcy had set for himself. So you had that the groups that came against him were the young and the old, the university professors, the administrators, the bureaucrats, the people that were not members of the Muslim Brotherhood. These are the people that came in and went out on the streets, and the secularists of all kinds in Egypt. And so, in the end, those are the people that were against him, and they mobilized. The army was, was behind these protests because they were finished with Marcy after he showed his true colors, and he began to brag that he was going to bring down this group, and he had changed out their command structure, and so they were being threatened, and also he changed out the central bank of Egypt. He changed over the director of that, and so they felt threatened somewhat there. They were recommending an extension of the existing director of the central bank of Egypt, and he went ahead and appointed a new one at that time. So there were differences that they had, and he also appointed a new leader of the military command group. And so this was Sisi, and he felt like Sisi would be on his side. In the end, General Sisi is the one that made the announcement to have him removed. So that's the way things happen sometimes. But the situation now is that Sisi announced, and you can read that on the website if you go in there, they suspended. There was actually no parliament in session at the time. They suspended the country's constitution provisionally, whatever exactly that means. President Morsi was removed from office by the military group. He was criticized for consolidating his power. He was actually moved against and arrested. He is under arrest at this time for insulting the judiciary. Several of the decrees that he had put forth in November of last year, of 2012, concerned the judiciary. And in doing that, then they have him now on charges of insulting the judiciary. He was replaced by Adli Mansour, who had only been for 2 days head of the Supreme Constitutional Court. He'd been head for 2 days, and then all of a sudden, he's the interim president. And he was sworn in at the Supreme Constitution building on July 4th, 2013, that would be Thursday of this week. He said in his swearing-in ceremony, the acting president or interim president, that he welcomed all parties, including the Muslim Brotherhood, in joining in to the political process. The Muslim Brotherhood has announced that they would be boycotting the process, and I think that's a major mistake at this time. And there were some extreme militant groups within the Muslim Brotherhood that started some problems. The military, the armed forces, has put out a name list of people wanted, mostly Muslim Brotherhood people, of about 200 people. So, and then, of course, they have Morsi and others, some of the top leadership and his aides, in detention. So, that's the situation that the military, you could call it junta or whatever, you know, I mean, they've been in power for so long now. And what they've done is they made a habit of taking out these leaders with these coup d'etats, see. So, what was going on, I'd like to get into this a second before we move on to any other areas, is that what was actually happening to Egypt during this last year that Morsi was in power. The crime in Cairo on weekends, in the murders were up 130%, robbery 350%, kidnappings 145%. Bad things were going on. You could see people being lynched in public while others took pictures of the scene. And, right, so Mohamed El Baradei in Foreign Policy magazine said it reminded him of the French Revolution. And he is being proffered by the group, the international group, as a possibility of taking over. And they're going to set a new election 6 to 8 months and then elect a new president and of the so-called republic. The economy over there was beginning to have real problems. Youth unemployment was 25%. The new jobs were almost non-existent being created, and prices were soaring. There were continuing shortages of gasoline leading to long lines at the pumps. Also, they had roving power cuts. They had power cuts that were frequent. And the farmers, of all the people that needed fuel, they were having trouble getting fuel for their tractors to go out and grow the wheat that they sorely needed during this problem of not having enough production in their own country, having to import 50% of the wheat that they consumed. The mobs out there, the demonstrators, the protesters, however you would want to describe these people, there was a plethora of different kinds of adversaries on the streets. There were young and old. There was this urban people, liberals, secularists of all kinds. The newer party also gave support to President Morsi's adversaries. But overall, this motley group, it was they found it was difficult over this last year to begin to live and feed their families because of the inflation of goods and services. Bakery owners of bakeries were having to hold their prices as low as much they could, but their materials were going up on them. And there were several bakeries that eventually wanted to go up. They were trying to hold the prices low to maintain business. Also, and a very important part of Morsi's, you could say, thinking, okay, was that he was a supporter, okay, of 9/11 conspiracy theories. And I have in there a piece written in the Washington Post entitled "Getting Egypt's Morsi to Give Up His 9/11 Truther Talk," written in the Washington Post by Robert Satloff and Eric Traeger. And in there, they discussed the need to get Morsi to pressure him to give up this so-called 9/11 truther talk, you know. And what was behind his removal, I think, was this also. I think one of the factors was his 9/11 truth, you know what I mean, adherence to that, his belief in that. And I believe about 70% of the Egyptian people They don't believe the government explanation of 9/11 that the United States government, the federal government, has put out. And so you've got about 70% people in Egypt, doesn't matter who they are, Muslim Brotherhood or not, that don't believe Washington's, version of 9/11. So that's another key factor also. I believe this was a major factor because they would not want to have a president with those kinds of views. So he sort of undid himself by not concentrating on the economy. Even he might not have been able to do much, but he could have done something. So that's another factor also. There's a good article in Al Jazeera about the neoliberals. The word neoliberal is not used in this country very often. It's a term that you'll use by the Europeans to a great extent, but not by Americans. And what it is Thatcherism. It's open markets. It's public-private partnerships. It's you take things that were privately public and you privatize the privatization from the public to the private. These are some of the ideas that the neoliberals were trying to bring into Egypt at the time. Now, with the military owning 35 to 40%, between 20% on the low up to 40% on the high estimate, and maybe 35 to 40% would be a good estimate, they were really hesitant and fearful of that move. This move started in the early 2000 period under Mubarak. So Mubarak was persuaded by Baradi and these other people to open up the economy to foreign investment. And that was what was beginning to go on in the early 2000s before Mubarak was moved against. And so there again, the military could easily have been the factor, one of the main factors behind. They say that the way that they portray themselves is very, very interesting. They'll say things like, let me go up here and I'll find the actual speech up here. But it's so, you know what I mean? Securing and guaranteeing freedom of expression, freedom of media, all necessary measures will be taken to empower youth so they may take part in decision-making processes. This is Sisi's speech when they dismissed President Morsi. Okay, the armed forces warn it will stand up firmly and strictly to any act deviating from peacefulness based on its patriotic and historic responsibility. So they're the protector of Egypt. That's how they're trying to portray themselves to the actual citizen on the street. Now, as far as being a protector there, they're protecting their interest. They own a good portion of the economy, and so actually what they are protecting is their vested interest. But that's not widely disseminated in Egypt. In fact, you just don't print that over there, or you won't be a reporter or a journalist very long. It's not like this country. We still have some freedoms, and people have to have things to, you know, search warrants or some. They have to have something to come after you with warrants or something. But Egypt is something else. It's still not like this. It's coming out of a series of very powerful individuals, strong men type rule. It's not like America, where we can at least pass on the reins of government from one president to another peacefully. At the end of this, I give certain solutions that I believe would be good, but I'm not very optimistic. I'm not optimistic because the military is still there and they're in power and they have a monopoly of force. The subsidies, like I touched on earlier about bread being less than a cent, flatbread, when you find it thrown away into the street, then the subsidy is too great the price of it is not high enough. They need to get the price of flatbread up by lowering the subsidy. That would save millions into the billions, possibly. They have a large bureaucracy there in Egypt. It was first started because when Nasser came in, he socialized. He was on the social side, socialist side. So what he did was he naturally took over from business and private business into the hands of the government. And so this expanded government and more of a statist system. And this created a tremendously large bureaucracy that was fed by university students for years. They would go to the university, colleges, and then come out of there, and they would have a job in government after they graduated. But today, that bureaucracy is costing a tremendous amount and the causing the economy overall to be inefficient. That's the real problem. But to just flip this over very quickly or to change it is not going to be possible. Not with the military ensconced in there with a tremendous ownership interest in business and the economy at large. So you're not going to have anything that's going to happen just overnight in Egypt. Number three, farmland. I believe they need to get back to much more incentives to small farmers to get that production of wheat up. If the wheat that they're growing doesn't have enough gluten in it to hold the bread together, then they need to change over to a better wheat. Also, the IMF has been going in there. El Baradei, this kind of guy that's being proffered as the new presidency. He's strictly in there with the internationalists, okay? And as a result, they want the IMF wants to get in there and just make a more and more loan, the World Bank, and so forth. And but care should be not to increase these foreign loans and try to work out of the existing loans into a better firm footing for Egypt to not be reliant on, but for only a short period of time, on these loans. Number five, increase the small business numbers. What they need to do is they need to get in there and stimulate, like some kind of a small business administration, get in there and teach people how to run businesses and make them low interest rate loans and give them incentives like that to create businesses and manufacturing businesses. But now, and I'll tell you why some of this stuff is not going to happen here in the end, in a second. Number six. They need to audit the armed forces and bring their ownership of the economy under control. And then number seven, the armed forces is operating with secret budgets that no one knows about, and they're not making them public. They say, oh, we've got, you know, 4% or something of the budget or whatever it is, you know, on paper there. But they are not revealing exactly everything that they have coming in. So their internal budgets are not open to the public at all, much less what they own. The armed forces, they still have a monopoly of force, so I'm not optimistic about real reform in Egypt occurring. And that is really the bottom line on what's going on over there. There are some other details that are important to consider, and like, If this coup d'etat, it becomes, I mean, that's what it is. The U.S. federal law, they cannot continue to provide aid to countries who have toppled a legitimately elected president, top officials like the president. They have to cut off the aid. They're giving well over $1 billion of military aid and many hundreds of millions of other aid. So they're already discussing this and debating it, beginning to be talk in Congress that the existing aid now is not legal under existing federal law. So that's going to be interesting to see where we headed there. But those are about the gist of what has been going on in Egypt. And I think some of the most important thing to consider here is this military owns a tremendous part of the economy. They have a monopoly of force. So are they going to be that easy to dislodge from that position? And I just don't think they will be that easy to deal with. So as a result, then we've got to begin to understand what can and cannot happen. And what's going to happen, basically, is the military is going to pick El Baradei or someone like that that's an insider, internationalist, to go in, or friendly to the military at least. They'll get another president elected, so they'll have let the people let off that steam. The Muslim Brotherhood must be very careful not to aggravate the existing armed forces, where they'll start declaring that the Muslim Brotherhood is an illegal party. They've done this in Egypt before. Under Nasser, after he came to power in about in the 50s, there was an assassination attempt that was traced back to the Muslim Brotherhood, and they were outlawed in the country, and there were mass arrests of the Muslim Brotherhood, of communists and so forth, and other activists that they believed that were against Nasser's government. So the same thing could happen here. If the Muslim Brotherhood resorts to violence, and it's traced right back to the Muslim Brotherhood and to some of the higher-ups, then there's going to be hell to pay. The military would love to come in then and just outlaw the Muslim Brotherhood as a party, period, their party, and then, you know, deal with them as they may. I don't think there's about, in the election, there was 51% to 52% of the electorate that were Muslim Brotherhood affiliated. So you've got a large number of individuals, voters, and citizens in Egypt that are affiliated with or members of, or we could call themselves part of Muslim Brotherhood. So you're not going to be able to easily dismiss that many people that easily. So the military here must tread very carefully themselves in not alienating large blocks of the Muslim Brotherhood to where if the Muslim Brotherhood, they could take over Egypt probably right now. They could really do it. I think they could because they have enough numbers. And being Muslim, like they are Islam, of the Islam faith, the martyring of themselves for their faith and for the Muslim Brotherhood is a key factor that could take out this military regime. So the military regime must be very careful in dealing with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, they have the monopoly of force. They have all the weapons. So it's not likely to occur because they could put down. But if it got started, and they started taking weapons away from the existing military, and it started going against the existing military, and they started disaffecting. I mean, this could happen. It couldn't happen in societies where the Islam religion was not prevalent, but it could happen in this kind of society and culture where the Islam religion is prevalent. It could very well happen, so the armed forces, they need to be very, 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 very careful. Today, we've got to look over and see what is happening. In the latest news, we've got a plethora of differing things. The army is in control, they're saying over there. In Egypt, they've got helicopters flying around. Of course, they want to project, you know, that idea that they're totally in control and so forth so that they don't lose control of the situation. But with that many, there's fighting across Egypt as Brotherhood supporters told to stay on the streets. So some of the more fanatical members of the Brotherhood are still out there fighting. Supporters and opponents of Egypt's ousted president, they clash in. There's still clashes occurring in Egypt on Friday evening. This last Friday evening, there were clashes. They erupted on Friday night between supporters and opponents of ousted President Mohamed Morsi in central Cairo and other cities across Egypt. So the fighting broke out Friday evening between the Muslim Brotherhood and supporters of the government or the army. And they're talking about thousands that were out there in some of those clashes. So they've got to be careful. They're saying they're in control. They have these helicopters flying around. But they're going to have to be very careful in handling these large crowds. This is the first time that I believe that they've been up against a number of, well, like if you could garner President Morsi actually turned out 51 to 52% of the vote. So that's half the people, the voters right there that were actively voting in Egypt. So this is not any small number. And when you can turn out at the polls, to the polls, and get those people to vote, then you've got a hell of a following in that country. So it remains to be seen what is going to happen. As time goes on, you're going to have the Muslim Brotherhood. They've got to work. They've got to get back, you know, to their businesses and their families. And so you do have a step-down process that occurs, and the anger subsides some and so forth. And so you're going to see that that is going to occur in this also. So as tempers cool off, and people become more, you know, cooler and less resentful and hateful about the other side, then you're going to see them curtail some of these actions and be less violent prone. But right now, there's skirmishes and there's violence happening between the two sides in Egypt. And so that is something that for us to watch very, very closely. Obama tells brothers, "I've got your back." Okay. You know, Obama called for Muslim Brotherhood rule overtaken in Egypt. The Obama administration, this is on Friday, called for an inclusive political process in Egypt with a role for the Muslim Brotherhood. Okay. But it was all this, these initiatives were overtaken by clashes in the streets of Cairo. So as violence enters in here, promulgated by the Muslim Brotherhood, then you're going to see less of a negotiation, feasibility occur here. If he's talking about, oh, let's get out here and let's get together and talk this thing out and so forth, and they're out there visiting violence on each other, then it's just not going to work. But that's what Obama's trying to get going now. Hillary Clinton's administration was a disaster as Secretary of State. I mean, and to even consider her as president in 2016, I think it would be just a travesty of justice, much less she doesn't deserve to be anywhere. The Benghazi thing has not been resolved. You got the IRS scandal. You got the NSA scandal. You got one scandal after another that this administration has been mired in a quagmire of corruption. And then he's going over there, and Obama's going over there and to Africa and touring through Europe and Africa and so forth to put a good face on himself, you know. Mandela, you know, he's trying to say great things about Mandela, and Mandela was a leader of his people and deserves some attention. But you can see through this, it's so transparent, but Obama is just trying to put a good face and try to overcome these particular these scandals that he's been involved in, his administration has been involved in, and he's not going to overcome them that easy. The Republicans in the House are continuing to investigate and look at these scandals, and they're not going to be that easily given up, because it's a big political plum for them to come in and bring those people in. And that Clapper, he had to apologize. He was just outright lied about what they were doing on intercepting people's information. So, I mean, one after the other, Lois Lerner is going to be drawn, being called before Congress for for, lying to Congress, to contempt of Congress. She comes in there and takes the Fifth, but before she did, she made these statements, and I believe that she should have never made those statements before, she started taking the Fifth. But that remains to be seen how that's going to work out. That's going to be proved to be very, very interesting also. But the more that you get into Obama and you see, I had occasion to see him personally, in person down at College Station. The Bushes presented the Points of Light Foundation, I think it was, award to him several years ago, and I had occasion to get cleared by the White House as a reporter, and they went over us with dogs and everything, and to get in there and see what he's all about. And as far as I'm concerned, he's a shell of a man. And if his supporters can't see through him at this point, then heaven help us. We had a man a few weeks ago that we had an encore, McRaney, and he wrote a book about You Are Not So Smart, okay? And in that book, his main premise on it, or idea, was that most people are unaware of how unaware they really are. I've always said it with a little saying, the delusion hides the delusion. But another way to say it would be that we're ignorant of the fact of how fully ignorant we really are. See? We cannot see. We have this ego self, and so we've got to maintain that at all costs. And so we're continually looking around for very, very flattering ideas to continue that ego self. And so we're distorting things, and we're bending things and twisting things to suit ourselves. We're selecting information that is supportive of our predisposed ideas that we had, that when we first encountered in college, or we had a very, very influential or very a father or mother. They taught us certain things. They conditioned into us certain things. Our friends conditioned things into us. We begin to take on ideas, a base of ideas, a collection of ideas, a set, you could say, of ideas. And this set of ideas began to be something that we could believe in and come to stabilize our view of the world and become halfway stable and happy, you could say, and content in the fact that we really had it together. Yeah, sure, we've got it together. We don't have much together. But we don't ever awaken to the fact of how ignorant and how little that we know about ourselves. This is the same thing true with any leader like Obama or anyone else. If I could reach out to Obama, the thing I would say is, President Obama, step outside your ego and look back and see how you're being controlled by all these vested interests, and do what's right for the country instead of taking care of those vested interests. We need leaders in Congress and high offices that will take care of the country's interests first and business interests or whatever second. It's totally flip-flop the other way. If Obama could only wake up and begin to see, and he's maturing a little bit, I will say that. He's getting a little bit better advice than he did the first 4 years, first term, you could say, he was in. So he's beginning to mature a little bit better and see how he's being used and been used. But I know he hasn't gone for the Iran thing yet, so, boy, they don't like that. The forces that are pushing the Israeli lobby and so forth that are pushing to go to war with Iran, they're not happy with him on that. So that's one of the things that he has refrained from doing that I would have to agree with. Stephen Kinzer says that we've got to reset our relationships in the Middle East with two countries primarily, and that would be Turkey and Iran. He believes that Turkey and Iran are going to be the real, and they have already become, the real powers in the area. And so what we have to do is that we have to begin to establish, especially, we have a fairly good relationship with Turkey because they've been in NATO for all the years they have, so we've been part of NATO there. They're trying to get into the European Union, but haven't been able to do that yet. But, so what we need to do is that we need to establish better relationships with Iran, but with a very strong Israeli lobby, that's hard to do. That's why it takes someone that's extraordinarily powerful and strong of will and so forth in the White House to start doing and establishing peace with some of these countries that we need to establish peace with instead of war. We should have never been in Iraq. George W. Bush, that was the biggest mistake you ever made. And it did not do, and there's hundreds of thousands, if not into the millions of people that died over there. And we lost good men. The same is true of Afghanistan. We lost good men there. This 9/11 thing is just a put-up job, and it's taking our freedoms and liberties right down the tubes. It's dangerous. The government version of it, explanation of it, is wrong. It's not even close to halfway truthful. We need to work on that more and try to get the truth, the 9/11 truth out. And at least Charlotte and I bless her soul, have always put forward and advocated a reinvestigation, a real honest investigation. And Jesse Ventura said that on a recent interview on Alex Jones's program. We've got to do an investigation that is an honest one. And then with an honest investigation, then we can begin to go and secure what we all want to do and get hold of, and that's called the truth. So if we get it, if we can do that with an honest investigation, we can bring this out and we can bring the country out. If the American public is blind to this, and they still are, and they're not awake to 9/11 truth, then we're going to lose our country. And if they ridicule people that are like myself, that are 9/11 on the 9/11 truth side, they make fun of us and tell us that we're dumbass or whatever, then they're actually throwing the country away. They need to take time and investigate for themselves the 9/11 truth. The Pentagon and so forth and Building 7 came down later, and they need to go out there and find out for themselves. But anyway, we're coming to the end of our program here, and we certainly do appreciate you listening to us. We'll be live every Saturday night, 7 to 9 from now on. We hope to bring you the most up-to-date, interesting programs we can. Thank you very much, and good night.